So the holy month of Ramadan starts on Thursday, the 23rd. And to give us some insight into why it is considered to be the most holiest of holy months for Muslims, we are joined by Sheikh Suleiman Ravatiels from Lanesia in Johannesburg. He graduated from the Alim Fadil course in 2004, obtained an honors degree in Islamic sciences from the University of Joburg in 2008, and he's also a radio head. Welcome, Sheikh. It's good to have you.
Good morning, Clarence, and good morning to your listeners. It's a pleasure.
This is such an exciting conversation because, you know, we have a great history of interfaith happenings, interaction at a leadership kind of level. You know, I think we need to build the bridges on a broader kind of level. So let's find out, and this is the opportunity that you've enabled, for other than Muslims in Cape Town to understand the significance thereof. I don't know where to start, Sheikh. You can guide us.
Well, look, I suppose that Ramadan is synonymous with fasting. And by and large, people of other faiths or no faiths would know that it's the month of the year when Muslims fast. But what's the significance of the month in brief? Well, one of the reasons why it's a very significant month, and Ramadan, by the way, is the ninth month in the lunar calendar, and Muslims follow the lunar calendar, hence tonight we will be seeking the moon. If the moon is sighted, then tonight will be the first of Ramadan and tomorrow the first fast. In Islam, the night precedes the day. If the moon is not sighted, then it means this lunar month, we conclude with 30 days and then automatically tomorrow night will be the first night. Now, the primary reason why Ramadan has such great significance, merit and virtue in Islam is because the Quran, the holy book of Muslims, was revealed during the month of Ramadan. That's the first thing. The second thing is that fasting was made obligatory for 29 or 30 consecutive days during the month of Ramadan. Fasting is generally encouraged for Muslims throughout the year, and it was a great tradition and practice of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, to fast at least 2 days in a week or 3 days in a lunar month. Then if we look at the prophetic statements and traditions, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, has emphasized that it's such a great month, the first 10 days is underpinned by mercy, the second 10 days by forgiveness, and then the third 10 days by eternal salvation. And there's a night wherein, during the last 10 days of the month of Ramadan, when if you exert yourself in worship of the Almighty, you get, it's called Laylatul Qadr, the night of power, where one night of worship is tantamount to over 8 years of worship. And there's an entire chapter of the Quran that talks about the night of power. It's a special night in the year given by the Almighty so that you can make up for lost time and you can make up for, you know, previous weaknesses and shortcomings in terms of exertions when it comes to worship. The big question is that why fast? So the Quran itself answers the question and says, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ, so that you can enhance your levels of piety. You can enhance your levels of the consciousness of the Almighty. Now, how does this happen? I mean, what's the link between fasting and piety and greater consciousness of your Maker? There are various explanations that are given by scholars, but I will suffice for two. The one is that, you see, we are in the routine of eating and drinking. It's part of who we are. You know, you stretch out for a glass of water, for a sip here, for a nibble there. Now, when you have to fast for 30 consecutive days between dawn and dusk, and you've got to abstain from food and drink, which is ordinarily lawful, and intimacy between husband and wife, then every time you are inclined in that direction, and then you pull yourself back out of compliance and submission to the command of the Almighty, that in itself is consciousness. Yeah. So every time you want to reach out for a drink, or you're feeling a little of a pang of hunger, or it's your 10 o'clock tea time, or your 1 o'clock lunchtime, and now you're fasting, that in itself makes you more aware of your Creator. The other reason is that when you deprive your system of nourishment, so as humans, we're made up of angelic qualities as well as the carnal, bestial qualities, and that's where the test of life is, you know, enhancing the one and subduing the other. So depriving the system of nourishment for a period of time between dawn and dusk for 30 days consecutively helps you to get a bit of control over your bestial inclinations, your carnal desires, and to enhance your spirituality. Just to surmise, you know, Ramadan then, flowing from what I've just said, is a month when in hearts are softer, people are more charitable, there's a greater sense of charity, a spirit of brotherhood, there's great encouragement that, you know, feed others, help others who are in need. whilst it's not a primary objective, but when you fast, you also become more aware of those people who cannot afford to buy food and who can't put anything. But the main objective, to conclude, is about boosting your own relationship with the Almighty. We're all caught up in the rat race. Life is hectic. As much as we've advanced technologically and in other ways, life has become even more challenging. So for 30 days in the year, it's your annual spiritual service, if you like.
Yeah.
And there's then physical, mental, and emotional benefits that flow from there. It's about becoming a better version of a servant of your maker and creator.
An affirmation of your faith nearly in the process. Two things that stand out. I think what we need to understand, I mean, we can Google and we can know when there's going to be a full moon. Why the physical need for the sighting?
Well, it's based on a prophetic tradition that you go out and you sight the moon. If you physically sight the moon, then you are able to commence. There is jurisprudential difference in this regard. There are those scholars who feel that with the advancement of modern technology, you go by calculation. There are some who feel that you just follow the global sightings of, say, for example, Saudi Arabia, the birthplace of Islam or the Arabian Peninsula. But in our country, in the majority, the jurisprudence is more inclined towards an actual physical sighting. And it has its benefits, the kind of ambience and atmosphere that it creates, the excitement. Remember, you sight the moon every month because we follow a lunar calendar, but there's a greater degree of interest and excitement at the end of this lunar month, Sha'ban, to see whether Ramadan commences or not, and at the end of Ramadan to see whether you're going to celebrate the day of Eid or you're going to fast an extra day. So it has those benefits. It creates that kind of spirit within the environment where you don't know until whether the moon is sighted or not.
Right, that was the first thing that struck me. The second one is that the Quran, the early Quran, was revealed to the Prophet in this month, you say. In its entirety, I believe there's a period of 22 or 23 years for its revelation. Just talk to us about the revelation and how it manifested.
Great question. So the Quran was revealed, according to Islamic belief, from what is called the Lawh Mahfud, the preserved tablet, by the Almighty to the angel Gabriel, in its entirety, on the night of power during the month of Ramadan, and preserved in the heavens above the earth. And from there, it was revealed piecemeal over a period of 23 years to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. The wisdom behind that is, unlike previous scriptures, and in Islam, we believe in all the scriptures. We believe in the original Bible or Injil that was revealed, and the original Torah and the scriptures of Abraham. But the difference here was that each verse or each batch of verses then had its own unique context. Something would happen, there would be a development, there would be an incident, there would be a question posed to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and then verses were revealed in that particular context. At times, it would even be his enemies would object to something, would allege, would mock and scoff, and then verses were revealed. So when we study the Quran, there is that added nuance that each verse is not only looked upon in its literal meaning, but you look at it in the context of the revelation. So you've got the words of the Quran which are preserved, and it's commonly known that Muslims commit the Quran to memory, even young boys and girls. But it's also all the context, the causes of revelation that is also preserved. So each verse or a batch of verses that were revealed at the same time are then looked into the context of that revelation, and that opens up many different avenues in terms of further nuance and greater and deeper meaning to those verses.
Also, we want to understand if there is universal Islam, because we hear about Shiite, we hear about Sunni, we hear about Sufi. Is there a difference?
There are differences. In the majority of cases, for example, Sufi, etc., the differences are subsidiary. And it's jurisprudic in nature. The fundamentals are the same. Then there are those, and time does not permit us to go into the details of every ism or, you know, every ideology when it comes to Islam, but there are those who have differences in terms of the fundamentals. So there would be a grouping from the subcontinent would claim that the Prophet Muhammad is not the final prophet. Now, that is a point of departure, because that is such a fundamental that mainstream Islam would say, well, you're compromising on something which is a very at the very core definition of the Islamic faith, and that is to accept the finality of the prophethood of Muhammad, peace be upon him. So that's where the theological discussions revolve. Majority of these differences revolve around subsidiary issues, and everyone still fits within the broad definition of Islam, as has been classically defined from the time of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. But there would be certain groupings that disagree on some of the fundamentals, and that would then, according to mainstream, not keep them eligible to be part of that particular definition. But it is complex, and there's detail to it, because within each ideology, then there would be further breakaways and further subsidiaries. But you would see in the world over, they say that one in every third or one in every fourth human, depending on which stats you go by, is Muslim. The majority would be part of what is termed the Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah, that they all agree upon those fundamentals, belief in monotheistic belief in the oneness of the Almighty, the belief in all the messengers, but belief in the finality of prophethood, of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, the obligation of Salah, which is the daily five times prayer, the obligation of the fast in Ramadan, which is one of the five pillars, etc.
So everybody is going to be celebrating the holy month come Thursday or after the sighting. Is that agreed upon? Is that one of the fundamentals?
Yes. Okay. Depending on the sighting in their localities, yes.
Okay. Also flying from what you've just shared with us is that the Prophet came to nearly affirm the other Abrahamic languages. What would be the disputes if there's an affirmation from the Prophet?
Muslims believe that the message, the core message from Almighty via all of his messengers and prophets from Adam, peace be upon him, right up till the final prophet Muhammad, was one and the same. Belief in the oneness of the Almighty, belief in the scriptures, the original scriptures that were revealed, belief in life after death, resurrection, in accountability in the year after, and either punishment or reward. So those are the fundamentals. Muslims also believe that the previous scriptures were not guaranteed preservation by the Almighty like the Quran was. So there may have been distortions, there may have been adjustments, and that's where the differences will appear. And then there were groupings that were there prior to Islam that, for example, negated belief in the Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, or the Prophet Moses, peace be upon him, or elevated the Prophet Jesus to the divine, which goes against what Muslims believe has always been the core message, that the Almighty is one, he is unique, he does not beget, he does not begotten, and there can be none from the creation that can be compared to him. So that's where the differences would then arise. But it is Muslim belief that from time immemorial, as we would say, from the first message and messenger, from the first scriptures, the original authentic scriptures, the core message were the same. Subsidiary issues with regards to how to worship, when to worship, that would differ from era to era, from prophet to prophet.
It's an introduction to Islam and, of course, us beginning to understand Ramadan. It's significant. It's significance for our Muslim brothers and sisters. Chatting with Maulana Sulaiman Ravat. He's with Radio Islam International, a Radiohead. His radio profile led Sheikh to a TV platform where he hosts the popular Sulaiman Ravat show weekly on Hilal TV. Sheikh is also an executive committee member of the Jamiatul Ulama South Africa. That's the Council of Muslim Theologians. What is interesting is, Sheikh, stats are showing that traditional, let's just call it religions, are not necessarily seeing the kind of membership trends that they've seen in the past, or congregations are thinning. And it suggests that Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world. What would you ascribe such statistics to, if they are indeed correct?
I think two things primarily. One is Islam gives you a sense of purpose. You know exactly why you've been created, what's the objective of your existence on earth, what was your history prior to this, and what is likely to be your state, depending on how you live your life going forward. So it answers that big question, which science and technology has always been grappling with. It promotes and advocates a kind of servitude to the Almighty, where the more you submit to the Almighty, the more you are liberated. And the less you submit to the Almighty, the more you are then shackled by fashion and trends and ideologies and everything and anyone else. And the more you submit to the Almighty, the more you liberate yourself from everything and everyone else. That's the one thing. The other thing is, and Muslims don't like to call Islam a religion. They like to call Islam a complete way of life, because Islam has guidelines in terms of how you live your life in every asset and every facet of it. From the time you're born till the time you die, from the time you wake up in the morning till the time you retire at bed, your business life, your private life, how you deal with your children, how you deal with family and adults and friends, your role in a congregation within a mosque, your role in community affairs, your role as a citizen within the country, your global responsibility as part of humanity. So there's a complete set of guidelines that guide you throughout every aspect of your existence, coupled with that purpose of for why you have been created, and a balance. Islam does not go totally the route of fear, and nor does it go totally the rope of hope, that as long as you believe, then you can do whatever you want in your life. There will be no consequences here nor in the afterlife. But at the same time, nor is it that once you've faltered and you've erred, which is human, that there's no recourse for you. There always is, and the Almighty is most forgiving. So I would attribute it to those kind of concepts within Islam.
And a practical means, I guess, to deal with modern day life. Moulana Sulaiman Ravat, we really appreciate your time, your insights. This little introduction to Islam has been very illuminating. It is time for us to go to news at 11 o'clock.